Okay. Well, thank you very much, Paul. I enjoyed hearing David give his paper, and I'm looking forward to hearing John's remarks. And I'm sort of acutely aware that if David is fire and John is ice, I'm, with apologies to Spinal Tap, sort of the lukewarm water in the middle. And nobody came here to see lukewarm water. So I'll try to be reasonably brief. And it only gets worse from here.
I would just stop.
I thought I would say a little bit about each of the two major points that I took from David's speech, the first being that it can be both helpful and hazardous to consult the law of other nations when we're trying to develop our own law, and the second being that this construct of liberty versus security is really too blunt an instrument for effective and intelligent law and policy making. So I'll try to talk about each of those. I agree with David that it is both helpful and hazardous to consult the national security law of other nations. Helpful for obvious reasons. You want to know how other people are dealing with these very difficult problems, particularly the mother country. But hazardous because I think law, particularly national security law, really only makes sense when it's put in context. And by that I mean two kinds of context. First, any particular law needs to be placed in the larger context of sort of all the national security law that a nation uses. So I'm in agreement with David that there is some danger in cherry-picking the UK's preventive detention regime without considering the larger mosaic of UK laws and rules in which it sits. But also, I think you have to consider law as a whole in the context of governmental structures, national culture, history, and the like. And so I thought I'd say a little bit about each of those two matters of context. With respect to the first, law in relation to other laws, one of the things that David mentioned, and I would have liked to hear more about, and I'm curious about, is this rule in the United Kingdom that wiretapping evidence is generally inadmissible in criminal prosecutions and in court. I think that is an extremely important part of the UK's wiretapping legal regime and their whole national security regime. It's a very important difference between the UK and the US, and I think it can have at least three operational effects that are worth mentioning. The first is that even in a situation in which the UK government will believe or know that a matter will end in a criminal prosecution, still the security services will be, I think, willing in that regime to use their most invasive, their most exotic, their most cutting-edge surveillance and collection techniques because they don't have the fear of losing their sources and methods through exposure in a judicial process, right? If MI6 suddenly develops the ability to read minds from outer space using its satellites, it has no fear of doing that. Whereas in the U.S., if the NSA developed that I'm told they already have that capability. if they did, they would never use that in any case that would go to trial because as soon as that trial was over, all the bad guys are out there wearing tinfoil hats, right? They engage in countermeasures. Once you burn your source and method, you lose it. So that's one effect, I think, of that admissibility regime in the UK. A second is, and I think this goes to something David was talking about earlier, it may cause the UK government to prolong its investigations of terrorist conspiracies or terrorist activities longer than they might go in the U.S., longer than maybe the U.K. authorities would be comfortable with, because if they can't admit the evidence from the wiretap, they may have these guys dead to rights. They may know everything that they need to know, but they've got to go and look then for alternative sources of admissible evidence that will be able to be used to make the case in court. So it may be that they have to go on before rolling up some suspects more than they might want to or more than we might in the U.S., where the wiretapping evidence could be used and usually is very powerful. And the third effect, it seems to me, of this admissibility regime might be that it would channel the UK authorities towards more extreme measures, to include the use of this 28-day preventive detention regime that David mentioned. I think they now want to push that to 40 days or something. And it's interesting because I'm not the only one who thinks that. There is currently, as I understand it, a significant debate in the UK about whether to lift this ban on admissibility. And if Mr. Brown has his way, I gather wiretap evidence will be admissible. Politics makes strange bedfellows because, again, as I understand it, I'm no expert in UK law. You have on the one side in favor of admissibility the prosecutors, the law enforcement agents, and the civil libertarians, the British equivalent of sort of the ACLU. And on the other side, against admissibility, you have MI6 and GCHQ very strong, and I think MI5 is sort of with them. And the civil libertarians favor admissibility, as I understand it, because, number one, they're looking forward to the opportunity maybe to test the provenance of some of this evidence. But number two, the way they've explained it, they think it will result in fewer uses of the preventive detention regime, which they don't care for. So anyway, that's just an example to my way of thinking of how, if you look at a legal regime, you really have got to look very closely, and you've got to look at all of the interrelations between the various parts and the way the law affects operational realities. And that's not easy to do, especially if you are not really part of the culture and the history and this sort of broader contextual area that I think law operates within. And if you don't have the appreciation of that broader, still broader context, I think you can lose sight of a lot of the lessons that you should be drawing. I'll give you a story that illustrates the British perspective, I think, on some of the cultural and non-legal differences between our two countries. You may remember in early 2003, I was still in the U.S. government at that point, the space shuttle broke up over Texas, and debris rained down along our southwest border with Mexico. You may also recall that the FBI deployed a number of agents. In fact, many, 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 if not almost all, of the FBI agents were at various points traipsing along through the underbrush looking for pieces of the shuttle, either toxic stuff or perhaps classified stuff that had rained down. And I remember talking to a representative of MI5 who said something to the effect of that this deployment, this mass deployment of FBI agents to clean up pieces of the shuttle, illustrated everything that was best and worst about American national security needs, capacities, and strategies. And I didn't fully appreciate, I think, the significance of those remarks, but I have had many, many occasions to revisit them in my mind since then. And I'm looking out and getting sort of a sea of slightly puzzled faces. So without trying to be cryptic, let me just sort of give you some sense of what I think this guy meant, or at least what I took away from it. On the one hand, right, the U.S. is this enormously vulnerable, huge sitting duck of a target with a big border on the south and a big border on the north, both of which are somewhat porous. And more generally, it's just a target-rich environment. I mean, we're so big, you could never harden every target in the United States. I mean, you can, you know, just go anywhere and blow something up. At the same time, we have almost an embarrassment of riches in terms of our capacity, right? I mean, 10,000 FBI agents, any number of thousands of local and state law enforcement officers, an intelligence community. It's a whole community, you know, with 16 members. The Brits have, you know, 3 members in their intelligence community, or 4 or 5 if you really are generous in your counting. But, I mean, they're, you know, small. So we have great, you know, needs, vulnerabilities and needs and great capacities. And then I think he was also sort of saying, like, and, you know, what are you doing? You're deploying your sort of elite, you know, counter-terror guys to go pick up pieces of plastic from the brush in the southwest, you know. So I'm not, anyway. So there's a little vignette about sort of what at least I think the British think about the differences between us. They think that they are much smarter. But I actually want to focus on what I think was David's second point, and in some ways I think the more profound takeaway for our own domestic purposes going forward, and that is that this liberty-security dichotomy is much too simple a construct It's not that it's wrong. You've got to think about the balance of liberty and security. It's just that you've got to go further and refine your analysis. And David talked about the sort of what I'll call intramural trades, not trades between liberty and security, but between liberty and privacy, or between liberty and of one sort and liberty of another sort, one person's liberty, another person's liberty. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. We do need to think about that, and if we don't, we're missing something. I think there are two other ways in which the liberty-security construct falls short. One is that it suggests that ultimately liberty and security are in a zero-sum game in tension with one another, you know, that you can have more liberty or more security, but not more of both, you know, like tastes great, less filling. I think that is often the case, but not always. And I'm going to give you, if I can, an example of a policy which I think enhanced both liberty and security after 9/11. You may disagree, but I'm going to give it a shot. And then the third final shortcoming to the liberty-security paradigm, I think, is that it sort of focuses on the initial question of whether government has power and then ignores all of the absolutely critical second-order questions about how that power is expressed and exercised and who has it and all these things. So again, and I'll try to give you an example there if time and you permit it. I mean all of you, not just you. You can see an example, I think, of this first shortcoming, this need for intramural trade-offs, in the current debate over modernizing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. This is very much in the news, at least back where I live in Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway. A lot of talk about updating this FISA statute that David talked about. For those who don't sort of live and breathe this, and lucky you, FISA is a 1978 statute that regulates some, but not all, of the U.S. government's foreign intelligence wiretapping. And where FISA does apply, it requires what I'll call a targeted approach. It requires the government to identify a target, to establish some kind of probable cause about that target, and to show that the target is using a particular communications facility before it wiretaps that facility. So it might show that probable cause that David Criss is a terrorist and he uses his home phone, so we're going to tap the home phone. It's a targeted kind of surveillance in the sense that it's relatively, and I mean relatively here, narrow, but quite deep. If I am the target, you can bet that some FBI agent or NSA case officer or somebody like that is listening to every phone call to or from me, reading every email I send, every other form of electronic communication. They're probably searching my house when I go out to dinner with the wife and kids. And they're not telling me about any of this ever unless they bring some kind of proceeding against me. Okay, so it is a narrow, but it's a very deep invasion of privacy. Outside of the FISA world, there aren't these kinds of targeting decisions made. It's a requirements-based approach. The Director of National Intelligence or some group of senior officials set requirements, like go out and collect on the order of battle of the army of the government of Zendar. Zendar's the fake country you always use when you don't want to say Soviet Union or something like that. Go out and collect on the order of battle of Zendar's Third Army. Let me know what you find. It's broad, and they go out, and in some cases, this kind of surveillance will be sort of, rather than being narrow and deep, will be kind of wide and shallow. They go out there and, you know, just sort of feel their way around. And sometimes, if you believe the newspaper reports, it might involve like machine triage of communications. That is sort of anonymous black box scanning of vast, you know, fat pipes through which many, 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 many communications are flowing. And then a tiny number of those being selected out for further review. And fundamentally, the debate about FISA modernization, at least in one of its important aspects, is about how much of our foreign intelligence surveillance should be under this targeted regime and how much under this sort of broader regime. And it will pose a question, therefore, of the sort that David was posing for you. Which would you rather have? A regime in which everybody's international communications are scanned anonymously by machine, and only a select few then pulled out for further analysis, or a regime in which a relatively large number of individuals are targeted for deep and invasive surveillance of their international and domestic communications. This is just an example, but it's, I think, shows the kinds of trade-offs that we as a nation may very well be asked to consider and make in the years ahead because of the way technology is advancing and changing. So that's sort of my first riff off of David's basic point, I think, that you sometimes got to trade liberty against liberty, not just liberty against security. My second example was that, you know, you could sometimes develop policies, if you're smart, that enhance both liberty and security, that don't leave you in that zero-sum conundrum. And let me throw one out as a contender, and that is the policy that took down this so-called FISA wall. David mentions it in a footnote in his paper. But essentially, this was a common understanding shared by all three branches of the federal government at various times, rooted in an interpretation of law that limited the coordination between intelligence officials and law enforcement officials whenever they were using or wanted to preserve the option to use FISA to do surveillance. It effectively kept the law enforcement guys away from the intel guys with respect to domestic surveillance to a greater or lesser degree. Now, this is obviously bad for the value of security, right? I mean, the U.S. federal government, if nothing else, is a big lumbering bureaucracy. And like any big bureaucracy, lumbering or otherwise, it doesn't work as well as it could unless all of its constituent parts are allowed to sort of, you know, share information and coordinate and work together. So you might have a situation under this FISA wall regime with two squads of FBI agents, each investigating the same target, but not allowed to talk to one another. So you'd have an intelligence investigation of terrorist X and a law enforcement investigation of terrorist X and two groups of agents, and they can't share what they find or take advice from one another or from the prosecutors who are working with the law enforcement investigation. This separate but equal regime was expressly designed to prevent the government from connecting the dots in the name of important values of privacy. I think it was ultimately misguided, but that's exactly what it was designed to do, and I think what it did do. It was not good for the government's effectiveness in keeping us safe and secure. I want to argue, though, and this I assume will draw some disagreement, that the wall was also bad for liberty and privacy, not just for security. It was bad for everything because it kept the DOJ lawyers out of these domestic intelligence investigations. For the last 30 years, the U.S. government has tried to protect civil liberties against intelligence community abuse primarily through lawyer oversight. This was the fundamental insight of the Church Committee in the 1970s. After it cataloged a horrendous parade of abuse that would curl your hair. It's truly grotesque. And what they found and what they prescribed was DOJ oversight of intelligence community activities. Well, if you have a regime that keeps 90% of DOJ lawyers out of these investigations, you lose the lawyer oversight that you get with the wall down. Also, the wall reduced the effectiveness of law enforcement remedies for national security problems. With no prosecutors at the interagency table, you know, when the government's got a problem, right, it sees a bad guy or some bad situation, what you want is a world in which they all sit down around the table and they brainstorm. Maybe we've got a diplomatic solution here. Maybe we've got a law enforcement solution, an intelligence solution, a military solution, whatever it is. And everybody is, you know, shucking and jiving and sort of brainstorming and trying to figure out what's going to work. But if the prosecutors are not at that table, then law enforcement remedies are deprived of their main champions and, frankly, of the people who even can spot the law enforcement remedy. And this channels the government to more extreme measures when it feels the need to detain. I mean, I think this is a point similar to the one David was making. Not that there's, you know, necessarily anything wrong with military tribunals. I mean, I don't want to sound like Seinfeld or anything, but the whole point of a military tribunal, right, the Supreme Court says in Hamdi, is that it involves less protection for the crook or for the defendant, you know? That's the whole idea. So, you know, a system that channels the government in that direction is not one, I think, that ought to be applauded by civil libertarians. And as I say, I think, you know, we are both more safe and more free in a world with the FISA wall down. So I don't say that that's a common occurrence. I don't say that we are not often stuck in a zero-sum game, but I think we're not always stuck in a zero-sum game. And if we could just be clever enough, I think there are lots of, at least some situations in which we could sort of work our way out of the box. And to my mind, the FISA wall coming down is one of those. Okay, my last sort of criticism, if you will, of the liberty-security dialectic as a construct for wise policy and legal reform. It ignores all these second-order questions that you have to ask after you have asked the first-order question, which is whether the government should have a particular power or investigative technique within its arsenal. It's not just whether the government has the power, it's how that power gets implemented. And this is, in effect, by the way, the same point in slightly different language as the first point that I was making earlier about the importance of seeing law in context. If you don't get all the nitty-gritty of how a legal power is taken up and expressed out by the government, you don't really understand the power or the implications for liberty or security. And an example of this is that Congress is today, or tomorrow, taking up reform of national security letters. And David talks about them in his paper. These are basically administrative subpoenas that are issued by the FBI or other intelligence community agencies directly. They're not issued through DOJ. And there's been a couple of reports by the DOJ Inspector General that, how can I put this? The FBI has had some difficulty implementing its national security letter powers in a way that's good. Should read the reports for yourself. One of the problems that the Inspector General reports identify is that the FBI lawyers who are assigned to review these NSLs, these national security letters, before they get put in the mail, they don't really get mailed. whatever. it's to confuse the enemy. the lawyers at the FBI who review these things, according to the Inspector General, have a little bit of a conflict of interest because they actually report up to the special agents in charge who are the ones that want to issue the letters. And have you ever had a boss? It's not, you know, I mean, you don't like to say no to your boss. And this is what the Inspector General finds. He says, well, these guys are not giving it the real scrub that they should be giving it because, you know, they've got this reporting chain issue here. So to me, at least, that suggests that there's a second order solution here, which is whatever the power is or ought to be, and I think the government needs this kind of administrative subpoena power in some degree anyway, it ought to be given not to the FBI agents, but to the DOJ lawyers, the way grand jury subpoenas are given to DOJ lawyers. And that's the analogy, by the way, that the administration makes to defend the need for these things. And I think that would fit in with the fundamental insight of the Church Committee, that lawyer oversight is the way to protect civil liberties. And further, from an operational effectiveness perspective, it would help foster the kind of coordination that you want between the law enforcement guys and the prosecutors in particular and the intelligence agents as well. So that's my pitch. There's a lot more to say, as always, but someone was holding up a sign, you know, that suggested I'm running out of time. So just to sort of sum it up, I think context, both legal and cultural, really matter. You cannot understand this law without that. And second, that we really do need a more refined analysis here than just a blunt bludgeon, you know. In America, we say like shotgun versus rifle, not bludgeon versus rapier. But we need something a little, because we like guns. They don't have guns in the UK. So we need something more refined. And I think David is on the right track in sort of setting up that more refined framework. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, David. What we'll do now is we'll, for the rest of our lecture, we'll hear from John Yoo, and then I'll read some questions from the audience, and we'll give David Cole a chance to have the last word since he had the first word. John.
Let me start by saying that very disappointed that all these protesters showed up to protest David Cole. And I'd be the first one to
views. I'd like to ask you. Well, I'd actually. Okay, I'd like to ask you to stop. Okay, now I would like to ask you to leave the room.
He's a war criminal. I'm not going to leave.
Okay.
Arrest him.
Okay, I'm going to ask the police to remove you.
Arrest him. War criminal. Hack lawyer. Shame on him. Torturer. War criminal.
Okay, we'll now have John continue.
Well, like I said, I'm here to defend David Cole's right to freedom of expression and academic freedom generally. I thought it was. And David and I have debated many times. I think now we're into double digits, I think. And we've debated these same issues over the years. I have a lot of respect for him. And let me just say, you won't hear me say this more than once, but I actually agree with David's basic observation about the difference between the United States and Great Britain. I don't necessarily agree with his conclusion, but I do agree with his characterization of the differences. I'd also like to thank Paul Schwartz for inviting me to this grand experiment in the First Amendment and free speech. I don't think he anticipated we'd have this much excitement when he invited me, and I appreciate that he did and that BCLT did. Also, let me say it's a real pleasure to be on a panel with David Criss. David and I served in the government together. He was a career appointee, and I was a political appointee. And David, in the time we worked together, I thought was everything we would want in government servants who serve across administrations and have no regard for being a Republican or a Democrat while they serve in office, but I think
moment again. Could people remain seated? You're certainly willing. You know, you can wear clothing as you see fit, but you're blocking people's views. Okay, I think I'm gonna ask you to sit down, please, if that would be possible. Okay, so now I'm gonna have to ask you to leave. Okay. Okay, would you like to move to the side? Okay. If you don't want to move to the side, I'm going to ask you to leave. Okay, and I'm going to ask the police to remove.
Arrest John Yoo.
Okay, again, you have...
Arrest John Yoo. Arrest John Yoo. Arrest John Yoo.
Okay. I guess actually what I'd like to say is, so there's something in the First Amendment called a heckler's veto. And I, as the moderator, don't think if people would like to stand to the sides, we've given you an opportunity to ask questions. I have cards that I'd like to have a chance to read. We'll have David Cole have a chance to respond to what John says. And so I think that's a great experiment in the First Amendment. But I don't think we should have a heckler's veto where a group of people can stop someone from speaking. So I'm going to ask John again to continue.
Hey, Paul. Should I go? Oh, okay. Good. So the basic point I want to agree with David Cole is that I do think there's a difference between U.S. and U.K. counterterrorism policy, and I think it is very much along the way He describes the United States has been much more aggressive in the detention and interrogation area, and less aggressive, I think, in the electronic surveillance and data mining area, and I think the exact flip side is true with the British. As far as I can tell, in terms of British law with regard to electronic surveillance, there do seem to be much less restrictions in terms of closed-circuit television, wiretapping, either getting wiretaps or using them, data mining, and so on. I also think it's true, as far as we know, that what David says about the relationship between the use of these techniques and British success in stopping counterterrorism attacks seems to be true. So from what we seem to know about the Heathrow plot in 2006 to blow up multiple airplanes headed to the United States, that plot was broken up, it seems, primarily due to the use, broad use of wiretapping and data mining by the British government from what seemed to be just a tip from a, this is just from the press report, seemed to be a tip from a neighbor that something funny was going on in their neighbor's backyard. And I think the British, it seems, used wiretapping and data mining far more liberally than we would in the United States to try to go from that one tip to fairly aggressive surveillance action to try to stop the plot. I think, though, that there are important differences between the United States and the UK, and David asked that in commenting we try to figure out what explains these differences, and I'm happy to offer some of my thoughts on that. First, I think the British system, to the extent that it still relies on law enforcement, I'm not sure that that characterization of it is fully correct, but the extent they rely on law enforcement has adopted a primarily, I would think, a retrospective approach to terrorism, in the sense that if you think about what law enforcement does, a lot of it is geared to finding and holding responsible people who commit crimes after the crimes have occurred. And there are a lot of protections built in to this because the criminal law system wants to reduce what we think of as false positive errors, the idea that you made a mistake in finding someone to be guilty of a crime or a terrorist who in fact is not. If you think about the United States system, what the United States system is moving towards is a prevention or prospective model where the United States is trying to glean intelligence, as David Cole was pointing out, in an effort to try to prevent attacks before they occur. It is quite true that law enforcement can sometimes be used to perform this function, but it seems to me that the case has not been made that it can do so in all circumstances. And so the United States is moving towards a prevention type system. It's more of right now, I would say, a mixed system. So here are my differences with David. One is, as far as I could tell from his talk and reading his paper, and I think I read it fairly closely, I actually could not tell that whether there was any policy that David Cole felt needed to be changed after 9/11. As far as I can tell, he would keep all the existing policies in place, not recommend any new measures, and essentially, if those old measures don't succeed in reducing the incidents or the magnitude of terrorism attacks, he didn't mean it as a joke, but I think the person who was saying it wasn't really serious when he said the British Lord, I think, said we just ought to shrug it off. I would differ with that. I think there are important policy changes that ought to be made that. The 9/11 attacks did reveal shortcomings in our security posture, and that it's only sensible after an attack like the 9/11 attacks that the United States would try to move more towards a prospective or prevention model from a retrospective criminal justice model. So how would we do this in a way that makes sense without causing the problems or errors that David is worried about? I mean, one thing you could say is my sense is that David would not accept a trade. So suppose the United States went totally to the British model, and the United States and the British took our model. My sense is David would not want that model for the United States. He would agree with half the policies, but he would disagree with the policies about less privacy, as he calls it, and broader electronic surveillance, broader use of data mining, and so on. I wonder if we could do that, if both, and maybe this is one assumption of his paper, is that both policies seem, in his mind, may produce the same amount of reduction in harm from terrorist attacks. Would we be willing to change, swap with the British, the two models? I think the implicit suggestion is, in his papers, that we should, or we would welcome that kind of trade, and even take it and then reduce the British system. I think it's hard to make that kind of comparison, and David Chris is, I think, quite right in saying that a lot of that has to do with the unique circumstances between the British and the United States, which I'll talk in a moment. But I think the other thing is we just don't have, and I don't think David's paper has enough data and evidence to allow us to judge. Right? So it would seem to me what you would want to do is first have a sense of the expected harm that we should be worried about with regard to terrorist attacks, the probability that an attack will occur, and the magnitude of such an attack. We would want to balance that against the costs of creating more precautions to stop those attacks. We don't really have a sense from the British model whether these kinds of terrorism policies are effective or not. We don't have a sense of how much they cost British society. In one way, you could say it is, well, the British policies cost everybody in Great Britain, but they might cost them just a little bit, right? Because they're taking away a little bit of privacy from everybody. David's claim is that the United States policy concentrates the harms on relatively few people, but doesn't really impose costs on the majority, if not almost all, American citizens. Right. So in order to make that judgment whether we would want one or the other, we need to have a sense of whether one system versus the other system is actually producing benefits and effectiveness. And the British have stopped plots. The United States has stopped plots, too, since 9/11. But it's very difficult to tell, I think, based on what the paper says, about whether one system or the other makes more sense, unless we had more information. The second thing I would say is there's a big difference between the United States and Great Britain. And for that reason, it's not clear to me that the British model policies would make sense here, just as I don't know if our system and our policies would make sense for Great Britain. One is there is a difference in, I think, and I don't think David Cole denied this, there's a difference in the type of conflict we're fighting. As I think you said, I mean, the war between Great Britain and the IRA was... Great Britain was essentially trying to occupy parts of Ireland, and the Irish didn't want to allow that to happen. It's a very different kind of war than the kind that the United States is engaged in. The United States is not trying to keep hold of a territory. It's not trying to distinguish between its own civilians who are supportive and opposing the government. I think the closest analog we've ever had in American history with what has happened in Great Britain would have been the Civil War, not the kind of conflict between the United States and outside groups. The second major difference, I would say, and I'm going to try to wrap up because we're almost near six, is there's no separation of powers in Great Britain. So you don't have the same kind of conflicts between the executive and legislative branches that you have in the United States. The British system can work more successfully because the British system has the leadership of the legislative branch are the heads of the executive branch. Our system is very different. It is designed to create tension and conflict between the executive and legislative branches. And I think that makes a big difference in the formation of terrorism policy. Another big difference, and I think actually this may explain why the British, at least in the political system, are much more sensitive to counterterrorism policy than David thinks we are in the United States, is the presence of judicial review. As David points out, judicial review does not exist in the United Kingdom. And all the basic terrorism decisions there are made by the political branches. I think because of that, they have to make the decisions in all their dimensions, in all their elements, and so they have to be much more sensitive to the costs and benefits of each policy they adopt. The United States, because of judicial review, I think is quite different. I think judicial review, and I think this has been reflected in work that doesn't have to do with terrorism, work that has to do with administrative law, or just the basic delegation of powers from the legislature to the executive branch, but the presence of judicial review may actually reduce the sensitivity of members of the political branches to the kinds of worries that David Cole is raising. If you have judicial review and you know that they're always going to be sensitive to civil liberties in your system, then you're just not in the political branches going to be as sensitive to civil liberties. You'll expect and may even want the courts to do it. But because of that, you're not going to have a system like Great Britain where members of the House of Lords or members of Parliament or members of the Cabinet are going to worry so much about it. Let me close by saying, however, one last thing, which is David Cole's, I think, arguments, it's not clear to me whether they're based on the idea that there's much more difference between the legislative and executive branches, or whether he's making a claim of the government as a whole is acting improperly in these areas and that it's up to the courts to overthrow what the political branches have chosen to do. Part of that is because I think, as he said towards the end of his paper, there's actually a fair amount of, I would say, consensus between the executive and legislative branches in counterterrorism policy. And I'll just give some examples and then close. One is the Patriot Act. David's quite right. There's some things in the Patriot Act which nobody had any problems with. There's some things which people, he thinks, should have had problems with. But the point about the Patriot Act, it was passed by enormous majorities of the House and the Senate. The Patriot Act doesn't represent some kind of conflict between the executive and legislative branches. The same case, I think, follows with the Hamdan experience. So in Hamdan, the court has said that the executive branch can detain people as enemy combatants, they subject to the process of habeas corpus. The thing about these string of cases is that Congress, after each of these cases, has intervened to try to remove the jurisdiction of the federal courts over these kinds of habeas petitions. Again, agreement between the executive and legislative branches. The third thing I'd say is the last point would be the NSA warrantless wiretapping program. Again, this is an area where I think most people expect the executive and legislative branches in a few months to come to some kind of consensus. Right now, if the executive branch was willing to accept the idea that telecommunication companies should not be immune from lawsuits, Congress, I believe, would pass a law right now successfully that would authorize the NSA wiretapping program, and it may be the case that the executive branch wins on this immunization provision in the end anyway. But my point is that in the end is that even though the separation of powers here creates much more conflict than it does in Britain, here at least there is still much more agreement, I think, than it may appear between the president and the Congress about counterterrorism policy. And so it's not clear to me to whom David Cole has directed his arguments. Is he directing it to the courts? I don't think so, but are the courts supposed to take account of the British system and, I don't know, the costs and benefits of the policies and use them to adjust what the branches have done, or is he directing it to the political branches? And my last point there is that in that case, I think the British system is well known to the American executive and legislative branches, and they have chosen not to follow it. So I close by asking, well, who's supposed to take account of these differences and make any changes to policy if they in fact exist? So thank you very much for being patient, and I hope you were all able to hear what I had to say. I'll turn it back over to Paul.
Okay, let me, before David responds, thank you, John.
Thank you.